Okay, just to start this brief talk off, I just want to revisit those quotations I started off today with. Simply because I think in some ways they're very, very indicative of the problem that we have in contemporary life. I don't think it's just a contemporary problem, but I think we see it exaggerated in contemporary life. And here's the Kundera quote again. Speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting, with avoidance, and slowness with memory and confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves, to others and the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us in our ability to observe, to hear, to step back and to wonder. Society wants to blow out the tiny, trembling flame of memory. Well, there is so much within that passage. I think I'll just dwell with this for a moment before we go on to looking at just what Merton says, which I think is much easier to look at. As many of you know, when we engage in this meditative process, this attempt to understand a little bit about the nature of the mind, a little bit about our processes. This process, which is generally called meditation, actually in Buddhist terms isn't called meditation. It's always very interesting. Some of you probably heard me say this before. In fact, I know some of you have heard me say this before. Which is that, of course, we don't actually meditate, we cultivate. And what we're cultivating is many, many things. Part of that is attention, wakefulness, compassion, kindness, and also concentration. It's not a word I particularly like, but I think it's one I'll just use here. So we can engage in many, many different ways of cultivating the mind. This cultivation is generally known in Pali and Sanskrit as bhavana, which literally means to grow something. In both languages, it means to actualize something, to bring it into being. It has all of these connotations within it. And so what we're trying to actualize is calmness, insight, understanding, compassion, kindness. I could go on with a huge list of things that we're attempting to cultivate, to found within our minds. The word that's used to, some of you may have come across this, the word that's often used in Pali is the word sati. And there's a whole very, very important teaching by the Buddha, which is the foremost teaching that he gives on, in scare quotes, meditation, is something called the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana means ways of establishing, ways of founding. The word sati is the word that gets translated as mindfulness. And there are four ways of founding mindfulness, four ways of establishing mindfulness, four different methodologies, four aspects of our experience in which we can focus upon founding this mindfulness. Now, the only reason I'm saying this is because not just do I think it's important, but I think there's something that connects with the Kundera quote, which is, in doing so, and you see this literally physically when we're walking, we slow things down. We begin to become much, much more aware of our processes. As you're all aware, I'm sure, hopefully you're all aware anyway, that in ordinary life things are going very, very fast. I'm not talking about the pressures that are placed upon us, but just our minds are operating extremely quickly. It's very difficult, for example, to catch things arising in the mind. As I often joke with groups, that generally speaking, I don't see craving arising for a chocolate bar. I find myself eating one. You know, it's gone that quickly, hasn't it? That there is no real awareness often of that. If you like, that seed being planted before you're actually engaged in the action. So when we're engaged in this process of sati, of establishing mindfulness, we start to slow the processes down. we start to establish much more of what I call a centered decenteredness. That sounds really strange, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Is we no longer associate at the center of our being with a self, but we kind of take one step back and we begin to look at all of those processes that we think go up to make ourselves who we are, including all our cravings, all of our aversions, everything that we think is us. When we take up this decentered stance, we begin to see things a lot more clearly. I threw away a little remark this morning, which is very much associated with this, which is when we take up this decentered stance and we have fear arising, that which observes the fear is not fearful. That which sees the anxiety is not anxious. There is no identification. There's no identification of it as being me. Often we associate very, very strongly with everything that runs through our mind. Yeah? It becomes us. So much so that we think there's a veracity to it, that it's truthful. In another area of my life where I work in, you know, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, we have this little phrase which is thoughts are not facts. Some of you might have come across that already. In Buddhism, this is very strong. The ceasing to identify what is arising in your mind with being you. If you want agitation of mind, associate with everything that goes through it. I used a little phrase, probably you might not have heard it or not picked up on it, but I talked about the theatre of the mind. You know, I just used it in one of the introductions to the meditation, the theatre of the mind, just watching what arises in the theatre of your mind. Well, the theatre of your mind here has casts of characters who walk on. You have those are the central characters, you have subsidiary parts, and you also have a Greek chorus sitting in the background carving about everything that's going on as well. So beginning to establish this still centeredness, and I'm not saying this is easy, and the Buddha never claims any of this is easy, you know, but he does claim it's worth doing. Yeah, he does not claim it's easy. But establishing what he calls a mind like a still pool allows us to watch this cast of characters and to cease to identify so readily with them. Agitation of mind, well, that's very familiar. Yeah. Many of us will feel in our ordinary day-to-day experience extremely agitated by everything that arises. And then there's all the other stuff. You know, this kind of stuff that Kundra speaks about, you know, is wanting to blow out this flame of remembering, this flame of, you know, recollecting what we're doing. Interesting, this word sati, which is this word we're using for mindfulness in both Pali and Sanskrit, has the connotation of memory, of remembering. But it's not, in certainly in the Pali version of this, this very ancient Indian language, in the Pali version of it, it doesn't have a connotation of historical memory so much, but present memory, remembering what you're doing, remembering what you're engaged in. Yeah. Rather than being, which I think is something that's encouraged, and I think Kundra really emphasizes that in that quote, to continuously forget. Yeah. And in forgetting what we're doing, where we are, what is going on in this present moment, we in a sense start to lose ourselves. And I don't mean that in a strong sense of some figure who lurks deep within, who's unchanging, but we actually begin to forget who and what we are as processes. Now, without going into detail about this, because this is not the time and place, we just simply don't have the time, is that the Buddha is highly critical of the idea of a fixed, unchanging self. He's not critical of the idea that we have a self, just that we think that we're unchanging. Yeah. And we learn to forget that we are, in fact, something far more interesting than something unchanging. We are a process. A process that actually is never at an end until death. Yeah? That's why change is always possible. It's going to occur anyway. But we take a fixed view of ourselves. We take a fixed view of who and what we are. We forget about the possibility that we have. The possibility that we are and can be. And we forget that. So we can live in this process of forgetting. And we hear this process of forgetting when we try to establish ourselves almost being like a thing. You know? Jean-Paul Sartre, some of you might know, kind of summing up something he says in Being and Nothingness, he says basically human beings, most of them, are trying to deny themselves and be like tables and chairs. Tables and chairs don't change that much. You know, human beings change continuously. You know, they have consciousness, and that consciousness is always changing. They're not things. Yet, have you ever heard yourself utter, even if not aloud, perhaps just to yourself something like, "Well, that's the way I am"? When you start to even identify yourself with phrases like that, "That's the way I am," you turn yourself into a something, an unchanging thing. Agitation is in many senses what is familiar to a lot of our ways of being. Now, I'm going to mention certain forms of agitation that the Buddha very strongly speaks about. Agitations you will come across actually a lot of the time in meditation. You've no doubt bumped into them today at some point, but they're there constantly within your ordinary life. They get called hindrances. And I'm sure any of you have been around the meditation circle for any length of time and engaged in this in any depth whatsoever will have come across this phrase. The Buddha speaks of being five hindrances. That word hindrance does not give a good reflection of actually what, again, the original language says. The word in the original language is nivarana. It literally means to veil something, like casting a cloth over something. And what it means is when we have these particular states come upon us, which I'll tell you what they are in a minute, it's a bit like throwing a cloth over, I don't know, that flask down here, this water bottle. Throwing something over the top of it, which veils it, which covers it. So I don't actually see what is there. All I see is a vague outline of what is there, and I identify with the cloth. Yeah? Does that make sense? Yeah? So I'm not actually seeing what is there. What I'm seeing is, in a sense, what I project onto the cloth, which is laid over the top of it. Now, the Buddha speaks of there being five types of this. He speaks very strongly about them as well. He talks about these nivaranas, these so-called hindrances, as being the five generators of mental distress. And the first one is sensual desire. You know, desire for all of the sensual goodies of the world, of which there are many, many, aren't there? They seem to get even bigger as time goes on. We all like sensual things. We all want nice things. We all want to have nice things. We all want those good things in our lives. And the unfortunate thing about this is it's a desire, which means it's never at an end. That's actually the way commerce works, isn't it? Trying to sell you the latest bit of sensual desire that you can have. Notice also how often that the things which are the things that we're desiring are often associated again with being a self, particularly in contemporary society, where, for example, you're nothing if you don't have this piece of sensual desire. You know, this will make you feel good. This will establish you as being a real self in this world, being somebody. And so these objects are not innocuous. The things that we grasp after, but they are very basic. Some forms of sensual desire, you know, food and clothing, warmth, shelter, Some of these are very, very basic. But then there are all of the other, what I call stimulated desires, that we have, that we are kind of, that our appetites are whetted, and that we want more and more and more of. Now, as you probably notice, and I hope you hear at least from what I'm saying here, although it's very shorthand, is that desire in this form is never at an end. There is always going to be something that you want or desire sensorially. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a little check you can do for yourself. And it's often a way of staving off contentment, happiness, whatever you might like to call it, which is, you know, the little stories that we tell ourselves, if only I had, I would be happy. You know, I'll leave you to mark the spot to find out which story you tell yourself. Have you ever noticed what actually happens when you get the X that marks the spot? Any clues about that? Yeah, it's, okay, if only I had, I would be happy. So in other words, it moves on to another object. And it keeps moving on to another object. It never actually finds a terminal point here. Oscar Wilde in Lady Windermere's Fan, one of his plays, actually said once, there is nothing worse than not getting what you want than getting what you want. Yeah, it's just as bad, isn't it? Because it's, you know, it just leads on to more desire and you're never satisfied anyway. So sensory desire is something that's never at an end. It's never going to finish. The second of these generators of mental distress is aversion, ill will. All the things we dislike. You might have had sensory desire about a cup of coffee today, you might have had it about a cup of tea, what we're going to have for lunch, what you're going to eat this evening, what you might be wanting to buy, I don't know, you kind of mark that one. Ill will is the opposite, it's everything you don't want. Everything you don't like, everything you hold a grudge against, everything you have a resentment about, everything that hasn't gone your way in this day, you know, for example. Both of these actually are good, very, very good qualifiers for this thing we call dukkha, dissatisfaction. These are the most potent indicators of dissatisfaction. Things that I want that I haven't got, that I'm desiring to get, and things that I've got that I don't want. Things I hold grudges and resentments about and I really don't want in my life whatsoever. And if you notice one thing, that generally life pans out in terms of that, I don't get what I want, I get what I don't want. A lot of the time. It doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't seem to present you entirely with an easy life in that way. All of this, by the way, goes under this name of dukkha, dissatisfaction. Yeah. Of being in a constantly dissatisfied state, agitation again. When there's dissatisfaction, there's agitation. Dissatisfaction in not getting the sensual things you want and getting the things that you don't want. Yeah. Now I'm going into these very briefly because of the time limitations we have, but I'm sure you can see these are generators. There's no stillness, there's no calmness when there's a whole raft of things that we don't want and there's a whole raft of things that we want. And actually this is usually very good at indicators of being a self. When do you feel most yourself? When there's something I dislike and when there's something I really want. Yeah? Actually, a lot of the time we walk around the world not really being a very strong self, or a very strong sense of self. However, bump into something you really want, or something you really don't want, there you are. Yeah. So that's the kind of constant thing that we come up against, just bumping into the things that we want and don't want in our lives. And then we feel very strongly that, as they say, there we are, that's ourself. That's often a very great indicator of ourself. So these are two very, very prominent dimensions. And I say, you probably have them today. Yeah. You've probably been things that you wanted, things you don't want, didn't want. You know, it's either too hot, it's too cold. There's, you know, I haven't got a cup of tea when I want a cup of tea, yeah, and so on and so forth. I could go on. I'm sure you all identify with those because they're so commonplace, aren't they? They're happening all the time. These are generators of mental agitation, mental distress. Yeah. The next two, and they come in a pair, actually, the you know, hindrances three and four come as pairs. The third one is really all when it becomes too much. Yeah. Can happen after lunch. A dynamic duo, which in the old-fashioned translation goes under the name of sloth and torpor. Yeah. Sleepiness and drowsiness comes upon you. Yeah. When in doubt, switch off. Yeah. When things become too much. Yeah. There is a sense of the way the mind just switches off, and this is what sloth and torpor are. Yeah. It's laziness. Not doing, putting off what you can do now. Falling asleep. Now, I might add, by the way, that this sloth and torpor, sleepiness and drowsiness, sleepiness and laziness, there's many different translations of this term. This is not just the kind of stuff that you get after a hard day's work, mentally or physically. This is the stuff that is really about avoidance. Yeah? This is a way of avoiding things. Avoiding difficulties, avoiding kinds of, you know, the problems that we have in our ordinary life. So this is very indicative of that tendency to want to switch off, to want to not have to deal with things at this moment in time. So when you find it arising and you've had a hard day, it's probably not the sleepiness and drowsiness that we're talking about, or the sleepiness and laziness that's being spoken of here. The fourth, which is again showing signs of agitation, restlessness and worry. Yeah. And again, I think these are fairly familiar, aren't they? Yeah. Sometimes called restlessness and remorse. Yeah. Remorse, I think, is actually giving us a little bit more of a key into the kinds of things that we worry about. I shouldn't have said. I should have said. I shouldn't have done. Yeah. I should have done. So these are about things that are done and said that we should have done or shouldn't have done, things that we should have said, that we should have said and shouldn't have said, and so on and so forth. Very much there's a degree of agitation there. We go over them again and again and again. There's no stillness to this. This is the sort of thing that wakes you up in the night. Restlessness, that mental agitation, which often translates as physical agitation. So, have you noticed sometimes when you sit on the cushion, you can't get entirely comfortable? You sit on a chair, you can't get entirely comfortable. You could have the most comfortable seat in the world and you'll still be shuffling around. And this is when mental agitation translates itself in terms of physical agitation. Its signature of mental agitation is often physical agitation as well. So if you've got restlessness of body, you've probably got restlessness of mind as well. If you've got very rapid breathing, you've probably got restlessness of mind as well. And this is very, very, again, indicative of this state. Finally, there is something which the Buddha speaks about as being almost the thing that pulls the rug out from under all our feet in terms of this kind of process, the process of engaging with meditation, engaging in inquiry, engaging in the development of insight. And he calls this skeptical doubt. Yeah. Skeptical doubt is paralytic doubt, a doubt which paralyzes you. Yeah. It's not just any old doubt, because actually doubt is quite good, usefully, particularly in the Buddhist path and the path of meditation in general. It's quite good to question things. In fact, that's encouraged. You know, but you question with a point of then being able to do something. Yeah. The point of this kind of doubt is that it paralyzes you. Some of you might know the story of Buridan's ass, something that's used in philosophy. This is a donkey or an ass that has two carrots hung on either side of its neck on a little yoke. And what it does is it can't choose between the carrots. And so it starves to death. Yeah. Now, I think you can see that as a model, it's a very good model for what actually happens. When we can't choose, we don't do anything. Yeah. When there seems to be competing things, of which I doubt, is that one the best or is that one the best? Is that the best carrot or is that the best carrot? Don't know. Won't do anything. Because I might miss out on the best carrot. Here, of course, you miss out on doing anything in life. So it's actually the, if you like, the feeling tone of this kind of, in a way it's an agitation as well, although it leads to a paralysis, because the agitation is can't choose between things, is that feeling of paralysis, of not being able to move on, not being able to choose what to do. Yeah. Now, I would probably suggest you've either had some of those or all of those today. Often it's associated with meditation, sitting down on a cushion, you know, particularly the last one. You know, which shall I do? Shall I do metta? Shall I do some insight? Shall I do concentration? In fact, I won't do any of them. Yeah. This is often what, again, pulls the rug out of our feet, from under our feet in terms of practice. So these are generators of mental distress. These are generators of mental agitation. Strangely enough, even the falling asleep, the not wanting to do, the laziness, as you can see, they're not isolated from each other. They're all associated with each other. Can be a way of avoiding that agitation. Can be a way of avoiding that agitation. Now, at the heart of these, there is no stillness. There is no calm. The Buddha uses one other term. It's the only other Pali term I'm going to give you today. It's a very, very important one. In our normal life, we're engaged in what he calls, and this is the Pali word for it, something called papancha. Which I did a quick jot down when I was in my hotel last night, which has quite a number of different meanings, but these are the most basic meanings you can get. It's got about 15 meanings altogether, this little word, but I think you'll get the gist of it here, because the word papancha means complication, rarefication, proliferation, exaggeration, elaboration, distortion, obsession, and obsessional thinking. And that's just the start. And that's what the Buddha is claiming that we engage in most of the time. We engage in papancha most of the time. Okay, so that's kind of the problem. Let's be very clear about this, because the way the Buddha sets out his path is, let's understand what the problem is. Let's really begin to understand the nature of the hindrances, one way in to agitation, beginning to look at it. Look at it arising not as a means of castigating yourself, of beating yourself up. Look here, I'm obsessing yet again about X or Y, and here's something I don't like arising yet again. Here is me falling asleep because I'm trying to avoid it, and so on and so forth. It's not a way of beating yourself up. It's becoming familiar with the tactics of the mind. The strategies that the mind normally uses in the absence of something which it deems to be stronger. When we start talking about papancha, we're talking about a general tendency of the mind to obsess, to proliferate, to generate all kinds of reflexive thought processes around self, around cravings, around dislikes. You know, if you notice how you don't simply have a dislike and go, I dislike that, really don't like that very much. It kind of goes on and on and on, doesn't it? Equally, when there's something you like, it's there obsessionally. Yeah, there's a kind of word connected with this which it very strongly means to bring up, you know, to obsess about all of this stuff. Now, that is the problem. That is the nature of our ordinary mind. And I'm not saying this, as I say, to make you feel bad, and the Buddha wasn't doing this to make you feel bad. He's saying, actually the reason why we engage in this is we're trying to search for something. We're trying to search for peace and contentment. Some people would like to call, might want to call it happiness. And we do it through all the wrong means. You know? In other words, we identify what we want and we think sensually, that if I get that thing, I will find the happiness. It can't deliver it. The other one, perhaps, is also equally there, sometimes even more so. If I can avoid certain things in my life, then I would be happy. You know, if I could avoid, for example, getting old, if I could avoid sickness, and basically if I could avoid death, I'd be definitely very happy. Yeah, but of course we don't avoid any of those, and we don't avoid an awful lot of other stuff that happens. Those just happen to be the big existential ones that I'm certainly not going to avoid. I'm not going to avoid the old age, sickness and death. But I'm also not going to avoid an awful lot of difficulties that arise in life. It's a fallacy to think that we can. So those are the two things. If I get this, I'll be happy. If I avoid this, I'll be happy. If I could make a decision, I'd be happy. Yeah, right at the very end. If I could stop worrying about things, I might be a bit happier. Notice the tendency of the mind is want to solve problems in certain ways. Yeah, it's trying to solve a problem. It's trying to get to some idealized position of comfort, happiness, contentment. Choose the word that works for you. I'm not hooked on any particular word. Yeah. In trying to reach those things, it does it with the wrong means. That is the Buddha's only criticism about it. So in other words, let's take a very simple one. If I had this, I would be happy. You make a very, very big demand. Let's take it on material things in providing happiness for you. The Buddha has a very graphic image, actually, in the text. He likens this to a dog sitting outside of a butcher's shop who's thrown a bone that's got no meat on it whatsoever. And what the dog does is he chews the bone again and again and again, trying to find satisfaction. Have you noticed, even with the things that we like and think are going to provide us with some degree of happiness, we don't kind of see that it doesn't work and then drop it. In the sheer disbelief that it doesn't actually work, we try it again and again and again. You know? Thinking perhaps it didn't work this time, next time it will. Yeah. That's called addiction, by the way. Yeah. That's why we get... The Buddha's model, actually, of the mind is very much an addictive model of the mind. That we're addicted to doing certain things again and again and again, but they don't actually work. They don't provide us what we're looking for. I'm aware the time is running out for this talk because I still want you to do some more practice this afternoon. So, if that's not the case, if we can't search for it in external things, we can't even search for it in people we love. Think of the undue demands we might make on somebody who we love. You know, when you say, make me happy. It's an enormous demand, isn't it? Yeah. Hopefully you can see, particularly if you've been along to days like this before, that that's not the Buddha's way. The Buddha is saying that this genuine contentment, this happiness, this peace of mind, this tranquility of mind arises from within. It does not arise from without. It arises from understanding the nature of the problems, such as I've just touched on very, very briefly, and it is very briefly, and beginning to understand that if we're searching for contentment, peace, tranquility of mind, a stillness of mind, that can only be established from within. We begin to establish it from within, not by denying the nature of the way that the mind works, but by understanding it. By being really, really beginning to perceive its nature and not identifying with it. There's nothing wrong with thought. There's nothing wrong with your worst fears. There's nothing wrong with your worst anxieties. Just don't identify with them. Just don't make them you. Yeah. to go back to where I started, almost like taking that step back, of not saying, this is me, not identifying with that thing. Actually, I think that thoughts themselves, even if they're really, really powerful, they're your worst demons that you could possibly have, all have a little label attached to them. And that little label is just passing through. Because that's what they do. One of the things the Buddha constantly returns to again and again, you have to take my word for it and go, hopefully go away and read some stuff about this, but one of the things the Buddha constantly talks about is that thoughts do this. They arise and they pass away. And they arise and they pass away. And they arise and they pass away. And actually that's the nature of the mind. A series of arisings and passings away. That's all. If that is the case, those thoughts are not you. They're impermanent, they're transitory, they're ephemeral, most of the time. And they're certainly, most of them, not true. Yet, we identify so strongly with them as being true and us, we can make our lives hells and miseries as a result of that. Yeah. So the Buddha's strategy is the one I've been, in a sense, exploring with you a little bit today, and most of the teachers who will come will do it in slightly different ways, will exploring with you, is actually beginning to get you to see that there's a way of anchoring the mind, a way of decentering yourself from those thoughts, from those processes, so that you can begin to observe them. And remember what I said right at the very start of this morning? That is the most basic stance you can take. Taking that little step back, not identifying with those thought processes, not letting them become you. In doing that, there is a whole world of difference between that thinking of thoughts and the observation of thoughts. That simple observation of them. And whether it's the hindrances, that's one way of exploring all those processes as generators of agitation, generators of mental distress. Observing the way the mind proliferates, obsesses. You know, and we can see where that goes. It doesn't go anywhere, usually. Well, it goes a long way, often from the very start of where it started from, that worry, that thought. It'll end up, you don't know where. But it doesn't, in a sense, get anywhere. So the Buddha is getting us to see that there is not a problem with that. Hence the reason, through the day, to kind of keep reminding you. It's not a problem. That's the way the mind does. This is what the mind does. This is the way it works. It will go off looking for more interesting things. I mean, what's in a breath? Yeah? Actually, there's a lot. When you begin to observe it, when you begin to see it, when you begin to realize the differences in each breath, the difference in quality, the difference in texture, the difference in length in each breath. That can only be discerned by bringing curiosity to that, as well as curiosity to those processes which constitute your much more normal modes of thought. The worries, the fears, the hopes, the joys, the things that are there, which are transitory, which are passing through. If we can begin to observe in this way, we retain a centre, we retain a stillness. Once you begin to touch that stillness, once you begin to really have tasted it, it becomes much, much, much more accessible. Again, I don't want to hold out any promissory notes and say this is really, really easy, just go away and do this and it's going to happen really overnight. It's not. This is training. And this is about training the mind to disidentify with the familiar. Yeah. To take all that familiar stuff and really begin to progressively disidentify with it. And to become much more that still pool Yeah. What do still pools do? Yeah, using that as a metaphor. Still pools reflect what is. Yeah. They don't distort, they don't project, they reflect the way things are. In all of its difficulty, in all of its wonder, and all of its beauty. But let's not underestimate the difficulty. This is something the Buddha did not underestimate. Life is difficult. But it's not as difficult as we often make it when we identify with those obsessional thinkings, when we identify, for example, with the hindrances. When we disidentify with those dimensions of our experience, by seeing them clearly, by in a sense becoming disenchanted. It's a lovely word, isn't it? Because to be the opposite is to be enchanted. To be in a sense under a magical spell that this sensory desire is real, is going to give me happiness, that avoiding this is going to make me feel a lot better. This is almost an impossible task. I always think of Moses trying to hold back the Red Sea here. Because actually life is difficult. But, and this is the big but, the Buddha says it's not just difficult. There's a great deal of beauty, wonder, and something magnificent about life as well, that we lose when we over-identify with all that familiar stuff. Okay, end of moral story. As I said, you will get a